And I'm Bill Radke with KUOW's The Record. Thanks for joining us today. Soon, Seattleites will find it a lot easier to challenge parking tickets. That is thanks to Stanford student Joshua Browder. He founded a service called Do Not Pay, where you can send a so-called lawyer bot information about your parking ticket. And then the lawyer bot writes a letter from a template created by actual human attorneys contesting your ticket. This service is already available in New York City and London, and so far it's got a 64% success rate.
Governments tend to be very incompetent, so even if their intentions are good, they have unfair tickets. For example, you know, they don't measure the parking bay properly, or the warden misses a few details. And so there's a question of intention and also incompetence.
Well, let's talk about your intention. We've been discussing how one of your do not pay letters might be effective in getting your ticket dropped. But what do you feel like you have any moral high ground in doing this? And if so, why?
Tickets are only dismissed when people are in the right. And from my experience with New York and London, the most vulnerable in society are disproportionately getting parking tickets. And people kind of laugh at this idea. But for example, if you're an elderly pensioner and you make a small mistake scratching a permit in London, the ticket is £60 and the state pension is £120. So that's kind of half your income gone, which you need to spend for food and heating. So this is completely free as a public service. And I think it's just meant to help the most vulnerable getting these tickets.
Yeah, and it is a luxury to have the time and the confidence in the English language and your ability to navigate bureaucracies. It does feel like kind of a luxury to be able to confidently write your own letter to the authorities.
And it's a luxury some people can't afford. So I just want to democratize access to the law so that everyone can stand up for their rights.
You know, I always had the impression that, at least in Seattle, and I figured everywhere, there's a good chance they'll drop your ticket if you contest it, just because, even if I deserved it, they're just so busy, they're not going to hassle with my paperwork.
Perhaps. And also, if you put forward any sort of good argument, they will drop the ticket. And so that's the beauty of this service. All these tickets have so much potential to be dropped, but people, as you say, don't have the English language or the time to do so. So this really helps people get them dropped.
I do wonder, though, if that's true, that you can get a ticket dropped just for arguing it well, if you are letting a whole bunch of people off the hook. Because I don't know about you, Joshua, but the vast majority of parking tickets I've ever gotten were ones that I deserved.
I'm not looking to help people get out of legitimately issued tickets. And when you say put forward a good argument, of course you need to attach evidence to make it a good argument. And you can't just say something and then expect them to believe it. There has to be evidence involved, and my site involves lots of evidence, for example, Google Street View. However, if there is any sort of evidence, then they will dismiss the ticket, but they're not going to just believe you and take face value at what you say.
Right now, this service is free that you're offering, Do Not Pay, but eventually you'll charge, right?
No, never. I promised from the beginning that it will be free, and I intend to keep that promise. As I said, I think parking tickets get issued really unfairly to the vulnerable in society, and it would be morally wrong, in my opinion, to charge them.
Really? So if I ever find out, Joshua, down the road that you are charging money for this, I'm going to write you a letter of contesting my interview with you and hoping to take it back.
Yeah. And you guys can be the first to break the story that I've broken my promise, but I'm not going to.
You know, this reminds me of Amazon's Echo product. It has a name, Alexa, and you just say the name, and it's listening to you and taking down your order. Do you feel like bureaucracy should be as easy to navigate as buying diapers?
Exactly, and I understand Alexa was kind of developed in Seattle, and Alexa is great because it's a platform that anyone can build on. I think it's up to individual developers to build on the platform something like a public service rather than just bots to order pizza. So I think if people use these great platforms like Alexa for social good, then they can have huge impact. At the moment, it's been a bit disappointing because anyone can just order an Uber anyway rather than having to talk to a bot to do it.
I wonder about your use of the term lawyer bot, because two things we don't like in America, at least we claim not to like: lawyers and robots, even though we love to use their services. But lawyer bot does not sound good here.
Well, I think the great thing about a lawyer bot is they kind of cancel each other out. people don't like lawyers, so the bots replace the lawyers. And I think that's why it's become so resonant. I'm just looking to describe it accurately, and I'm not, like, taking some buzzwords. Obviously, it can't argue in court for you, but I think that's an accurate description.
Do you foresee the end of the sleazy lawyer advertisements?
This is the exact type of lawyer that I'm looking to target. I'm a big fan of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, but unfortunately, I think those type of lawyers' days are numbered.
What other applications do you think there are? Technology making things easier?
After the success of the parking aspect, I realized that this issue is bigger than just parking tickets. So over the summer, I'm working on creating a bot that uses IBM's speech recognition technology to understand Arabic questions from Syrian refugees, answer questions in Arabic, and then produce legal documents for seeking asylum in English. And I think if I can get that right, then it can have a huge impact.
That was Joshua Browder, founder of Do Not Pay, a lawyer bot. His term, a lawyer bot that helps you fight parking tickets. It's coming to Seattle in September, and I'm curious what you think about it. Maybe what experiences you've had with parking tickets and the contesting thereof. We're on Twitter, at KUOW. Our email is record@kuow.org. I'm Bill Radke. Thanks for tuning into the show today. Supporters of a transgender bathroom law now have one more day to collect enough signatures to get that issue on the ballot this fall. The measure is Initiative 1515. It would restrict which bathrooms transgender people could use here in Washington. Supporters have framed this issue as a matter of protecting children from sex predators. Well, not all parents in Washington agree with that. A Seattle mom using the pseudonym Marlo Mack has a daughter who is transgender. They make a podcast called How to Be a Girl. And in the latest episode, she weighs in on the Washington initiative.
My friends from other parts of the country are surprised when I tell them that there's a campaign here in Washington State to pass a bathroom bill like the one in North Carolina. I have to admit that I was surprised, too. We're generally a fairly liberal, left coast state, especially on social issues. The bathroom bill here is Initiative 1515, which makes it legal to prohibit transgender people from using bathrooms and locker rooms based on their gender identity. Instead, they'd be required to use facilities that align with their biological sex. The initiative also contains a provision that says parents can sue schools if they learn that their child has been in a bathroom with a transgender child. As a mother of a young child attending Seattle Public Schools, this got my attention.
How would you describe the city we live in?
It's big and it's interesting.
That's my daughter. She's 8 years old.
Deer and there's trees all
and
around
she just finished second grade.
And there's grass.
She's a pretty typical 8-year-old girl.
Yeah. And did it come with two dolphins?
Yes.
She's got long hair,
skis?
Bright eyes, lots of energy.
And let's pretend we're like two chickens.
And lots of friends. She also happens to be transgender.
Well, transgender is when, for example, your kid is born and you think it's a boy, but it feels like a girl.
When she was just 3 years old, she told me and her dad that she wasn't the boy we thought she was.
What's your favorite thing about being transgender?
My favorite thing about being transgender is that I'm myself now.
What's the hardest thing about being transgender?
People might tease you.
My daughter is extremely discreet. Every time she uses the bathroom, she double checks to make sure the stall door is locked tight.
Do you have any advice for kids who are transgender?
And the care that my 8-year-old takes when she gets dressed in the morning.
Well,
breaks my heart.
If you're a girl with a penis and you want to keep it privately, I think a good idea might to be wearing dresses.
What my daughter wants more than anything, and what I want for her, is to just be a regular kid.
Slip, slide.
One of the gang of girls on the playground, giggling and chasing the boys. That's why we decided to keep her transgender status pretty quiet. Only a handful of the staff at her school knows that she's transgender. We've also told the parents of her closest friends. But no one else has a clue. Which means that the other kids at school would be extremely confused if Initiative 1515 passed and she was required to use the boys' bathroom.
Do you know what a bathroom bill is?
Yeah. where you flush a bill down a toilet. Just kidding. When they don't let people go in certain bathrooms.
The initiative offers one alternative for a child like mine. She could use an entirely separate bathroom from all the other kids in school, like the nurse's bathroom. I have lots of friends whose trans kids have been given this option. In almost every single case, it's a disaster. The other kids don't understand why one of the girls can't use the girls' bathroom. They ask a lot of questions. The transgender kid stops using the bathroom at all and just holds it, or breaks down and refuses to go to school at all.
What would you say to someone who says, if you have a penis, you're a boy?
And say, how do you know? It's not a rule.
I'm really not sure what I'll do if the initiative passes. If it does, any parent who thought their child had been in the girls' restroom with my daughter could sue the school for $2,500, plus monetary damages for all the, quote, psychological, emotional, and physical harm suffered, end quote, by their child. From having been in a bathroom with a child like mine.
To kiss her mama.
Oh, that's nice.
It's one thing to read about other places where things like this are happening. North Carolina feels pretty far away. It's another thing to know that it could happen right outside my own door, in the community I grew up in, the community where I always felt I belonged and was welcomed.
How would you describe the people who live here?
I think a lot of them are very good people.
My daughter doesn't know about Initiative 1515.
Do they treat each other well?
She's young enough that I've been able to keep it from her.
Very well, yes. So far.
The initiative backers are collecting signatures now.
We are love. We are one. We are
they have until July 8th to collect around 250,000 signatures. If they do, it will be on the ballot this November.
Yeah, how we treat each other, nothing more.
That is a Seattle mom who calls herself Marlo Mack. KUOW has been helping her produce her podcast, How to Be a Girl. You can find it wherever you download your KUOW podcasts and all your favorite podcasts. This is KUOW's The Record. Once again, police have shot African-American men to death. In Baton Rouge, on Tuesday, Alton Sterling was killed. And then last night near Minneapolis, a man named Philando Castile was shot in a car by an officer. Right after that shooting, as Castile lay bleeding and the officer was still pointing the gun, Castile's girlfriend live-streamed her phone video to Facebook, where many, many people watched. We're going to play some of that now, so you may want to turn your radio down if you don't want to hear this audio.
He just shot his arm off. We got pulled over on Larpiner.
I told him not to reach for it. I told him to get his hand off
it. You told him to get his ID, sir, and his driver's license. Oh, my God. Please don't tell me he's dead. Please don't tell me my boyfriend just went like that.
Just keep your hands where they are, please.
Yes, I will, sir. I'll keep my hands where they are. Please don't tell me this, Lord. Please, Jesus, don't tell me that he's gone. Please don't tell me that he's gone. Please, officer, don't tell me that you just did this to him. You shot 4 bullets into him, sir. He was just getting his license and registration, sir.
We have not heard that officer's side of the story yet. Castile's girlfriend, by the way, described the officer as Asian American. Minnesota's governor says he's pressing for a federal investigation. Meanwhile, in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Alton Sterling was shot and killed Tuesday by 2 white police officers. Cell phone video of that shooting has sparked anger and protests. A member of an anti-violence group says one of his group members recorded that video. Arthur Reed says he understands the public anger.
We wanted to be a peaceful resolve here, and that's not saying that anyone's afraid to rock the boat. If the boat needs rocking, we will rock the damn boat. But at the end of the day, we would like a peaceful solution, and we would like to see justice take place here.
Alton Sterling's aunt is named Sandra Augustus. She says she's angry, but she doesn't want to see violent protests.
I'm not angry enough to go in the street. I'm not angry enough to curse the police out. But I'm angry and I'm mad because they took something from me that I'll never ever get back. So y'all pray for me. But we gotta have peace and unity out here.
Louisiana's governor will be at a vigil for Alton Sterling tonight in Baton Rouge. What does it take to make these police shootings of black men stop? Connie Rice has been thinking about that question. For decades, she worked against and then with the Los Angeles Police Department to change the culture of policing. She asked police to stop being warriors and start being guardians. I asked her, what's the difference?
The difference between warrior policing and guardian policing is 180 degrees. Guardian policing is about problem solving, building trust, safekeeping children, making sure a community is healthy, and by making sure the community is healthy, you reduce crime. So it's a crime-fighting strategy that mixes sociology, good police tactics, and a bonding between the police and the community. Warrior policing is the exact opposite. You have extraction, violent-based policing that targets arrests as the gold standard. You want to take as many people out of the community, you destroy the fabric of the community, and you get rewarded for being aggressive within the rules, and you get rewarded by being put into SWAT and air support and other kinds of specialized units. But your basic mode of reward is because you are aggressive against the population and you make a lot of arrests.
Now, these could be deep and systemic changes, but we unfortunately have two fresh examples of what happens at the actual barrel of the gun. We have these two fatal shootings of African-American men this week with African-American men with guns. How does a warrior officer respond in a case like that versus a guardian officer?
I find that warrior cops are much more Pavlovian in their responses, and because that's because they've been trained that if they see a gun, they are in their rights to shoot. Our position with the Community Safety Partnership Policing, which is the guardian policing unit that I helped create with LAPD's Chief Beck, guardian cops are the opposite. They assume that a gunshot is the absolute last resort, and they will not do it unless their lives or someone else's life is in immediate danger. If you've got somebody on the ground and their hands are not in their pockets and you're standing on top of them like they were with Mr. Sterling, there's no reason to shoot. He's already subdued. And you saw that with, you know, how do you look, go to a playground and see a kid running around, Tamir Rice, and shoot him? Because he's got a play gun. How many kids have play guns? So the bottom line
but
is
you know, Connie, that in that moment you might not know that's a play gun. You might not be so sure that man on the ground is subdued.
Well, you're right. It's a fact. It's a situation-by-situation factual analysis. But when you look at the videos, it's very hard for the public to see what the danger was. There has to be an immediate danger. And if you talk to cops about these videos, it's been about 12 to 15 videos now that the country has seen. It has completely turned the politics, because it used to just be the black community that said, you know what, we get shot in situations that don't make any sense. Our black men are shot all the time in the street, and nobody pays any attention. Now people are paying attention because it got caught on video. Without the cell phone videos, this would still be going on, and it would just be civil rights lawyers like me bringing wrongful death suits against police departments.
Well, Washington's...
We now have a political movement that is saying, wait a minute, there's something wrong here. But it's both wrong for the community, which suffers these unnecessary deaths, and it's wrong for the police, because the police don't feel good about this either. And I know that's hard for the community to hear, but my job, and every day that I'm at work, I'm with cops. I went on the inside a long time ago to figure out, how do you transform these people?
Well,
how do you stop them from this reaction to poor communities?
Well, Washington State is a place trying to make that kind of change you've described, from a warrior culture to a guardian culture. Based on your experience with the Los Angeles Police Department, what does it take to make that difficult change?
Great question. Number one, you have to have a police chief whose hair is on fire for complete transformation. Not just tinkering at the edges, not just, you know, paring down a few policies, and not a bunch of speeches. You have to have a police chief for whom cultural transformation and complete radical reformation of policing culture from predatory occupation style, military style, warrior policing, 180 degrees over to guardian policing, police that protect poor children instead of arresting them. So what does that take? It takes a police chief who is whose hair is on fire for this kind of cultural transformation. Number two, they have to promote all of the real change agents. They have to know who the change agents are inside that department. And you have to replace all of the old guard people who are in supervision positions with the new guard, with the new cops who think about building relationships with communities, who think about building trust with communities. They want trust policing. They want partnership policing. They don't want warrior policing. So once those cops are in all of the positions of power inside of a police culture, then you're set, because then you can start replacing all of the old guard with the newly trained cops. And the training is the third piece of this, which is revolutionary. You are training cops to be in the trust business, not the arrest business. That is 180 degrees. You are turning policing inside out. As one cop said to me, "Lady, I'm not here to be a social worker." And Chief Beck turned to him and said, "Well, then give me your badge and your gun, because this relationship-based policing is going to save cops' lives, but more importantly, it's going to save community members' lives, and we're doing it. If you don't want to become a social worker, then give me your badge and your gun." I used to sue Chief Beck, and I used to sue Captain Tingerides every day I could. I had them on the stand in federal court every chance I had, because I was at war with LAPD. Well, you know what? We had to stop fighting each other, and we had to look at each other and say, okay, how do we keep cops safer, and how do we keep the community safer without killing people?
And how long does that kind of change take?
Well, we're in the sixth year with CSP. We now have 6 years of data that show no one has been shot by CSP cops. CSP cops have the biggest drops in crime of any unit in LAPD. CSP cops are revered by the public housing populations they serve. It's really quite amazing. I did not expect this level of success. So I would say it takes about 5 years, because we're now in the sixth year, and for the last 2 years, when these cops walk into the gymnasiums of these housing projects, they get standing ovations.
So what do you say to somebody, so 5 years maybe, what do you say to somebody out there today, marching, crying, in the streets?
Well, you know what? You know, the other piece of this that I did not mention, and it's bad of me not to have, because it's equally important to getting the change, getting a new chief, getting the new culture put in place. Equally important, the fourth part of this, and perhaps the most important part of this, is that the community also has to change. That was the hardest thing for me to do, was to ask grandmothers in Jordan Downs Housing Project, could you please work with the cops who killed your grandchildren? In these communities, the police have killed almost a child per gang family. And so when you're asking the community to reach across the table and shake the hand of the force that murdered their children, do you know how hard that is? But this community in Watts, the grandmothers, cussed me out when I made this proposition to them, as they should have. And then they called me back in 3 days and they said, "We're going to do it for the kids that are still alive." And because those grandmothers in both the Latina community and in the black female community, because they said the community is going to do this, we're going to try this, we're going to work with these cops, we're not going to hate the police, we're going to give it our all, because the community decided to work with LAPD despite the very ugly history in Watts, it worked. So it takes those four big pieces, a lot of smaller pieces we don't have time to go into, but if people are wondering, is there a solution to this? The answer is absolutely yes. It's the community safety partnership policing. It's transforming the culture of policing from warrior, militaristic, mean policing to guardian policing that loves the community.
Connie Rice, co-director of the Advancement Project, member of the President's Task Force on 21st Century Policing. Very good to talk with you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
You're listening to The Record. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Bill Radke. It's KUOW Seattle. The United States deports hundreds of minors every year. We're talking about unaccompanied minors, kids who are here on their own, but many of them could qualify for legal protections that would allow them to stay. Legal protections they don't receive because only about half of those kids get attorneys to represent them in court. Is that fair? Should the government provide these children with lawyers? A federal judge considered those questions this morning in a Seattle courtroom. KUOW's race and immigration reporter Liz Jones has been following along. Liz, welcome.
Hi, Bill.
So remind us first, please, why are there underage kids in deportation hearings with no lawyer?
Yeah, well, in the past few years, we've seen record numbers of children, primarily from Central America, El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, crossing the border from Mexico into the U.S. They are fleeing violence, persecution in their home country. There are laws here on the books that grant them protections if they come here to seek asylum. So record numbers increasing, the courts are overwhelmed, free services that provide pro bono free attorneys, they're overwhelmed. The administration has accelerated the pace of the proceedings for kids. So you're seeing more and more going through without attorneys. On the one hand, though, the government has provided a little bit more funding. It's increased funding to provide attorneys for kids, but only about half of them are getting attorneys at this point.
There is a federal court case that would change the situation. There was another hearing today. What happened?
Yeah, so this is a hearing. This is a case that is being heard in the district court here in Seattle, lower court. Today's hearing was at the appeals court. So the government has appealed the case, wanting to get it dismissed, saying the lower court has no jurisdiction to decide this issue. It's a 3-judge panel that heard the arguments today. And we'll get to the arguments in just a minute. But just to set it up, I wanted you to hear this tape from one of the judges, Judge Smith, who has been on the bench 10 years, talked about how complicated immigration law is, and then he posed this question.
I just don't see how realistically anybody can say that a child or a mentally deficient person or mentally ill person can possibly defend themselves under this. That's why my question was, is the government realistically saying, hey, we may not like it, but this is what Congress has said, and that's what we're stuck with.
I think, to be fair to my employer, I think we're doing the best we can with a bad
drop.
That's
all of you.
So there at the end, you hear the Department of Justice attorney come in and defend the government's practice, saying it's not the best, but we're dealing with what Congress has told us. We've been dealt. This is the hand we've been dealt. So the arguments, just the key points on the arguments. This is a case between advocates for the children, the Northwest Immigrant Rights Project here in Seattle, and the ACLU are two primary stakeholders here. Advocates for the children suing the Department of Justice. The Department of Justice says there is an existing process for this in the current courts where a child can appeal and demand the right to a government-appointed attorney. The advocates for the children, and they're saying that should be done on an individual case-by-case basis, not in this broad class action suit. The advocates for the children are saying it's impossible for it to happen. How can a toddler, how can a teenager go in front of the court, know how to make this appeal process? How can it work? They've never seen it actually happen. So the judges today were weighing both those arguments. And one of the lines of questioning was about, can't we have a test case just go through on the current system and see how it works? The advocates raised the point that we've never seen it work. If the kids say, I need an attorney, an attorney is appointed, their case gets moved out to a different system. They're no longer in the situation of being without an attorney.
Liz, we just have a minute left. I wonder, how does this case fit into the national immigration debate in this election year?
Right. So we're seeing attempts at immigration reform on various fronts here. We've seen the Senate take it up in a massive bill that was not taken up in the House. We've seen President Obama with executive action trying to get protections for larger groups of people. Supreme Court just struck down one of his efforts a couple weeks ago. In the courts, we're seeing this battlefront. And some people have analyzed this saying Obama kind of took a calculated strategic chance here and didn't really fight on this case and focus more on the executive actions. So we're just seeing very divisive opinions about how we handle unauthorized immigration, what kind of services we provide, what sort of funding we provide, how Congress will deal with that under the next administration will be a huge question.
And finally, what happens next in this case?
In this case, the appeals court will take some time to think about it, probably 3 to 6 months to get a ruling back. And meanwhile, the case proceeds on the district level here in Seattle.
KUOW's race and immigration reporter Liz Jones, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good to have you here with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Hey, Mount Rainier just got some love and some money in an online competition against other national parks. Rainier National Park won $42,000 for a restoration project. When the head of Washington's National Park Fund, Lori Ward, found out that Rainier was a winner, she was surprised.
We were up against all the big powerhouses across the country. And, you know, we're up
against Yosemite.
Yeah, Yellowstone, Grand Tetons, Rushmore, all of them.
Oh, Rainier's bigger.
Yeah, well, and it just was fascinating, the fact that, you know, this one up in the northwest part of the country that a lot of folks don't come up to, right, that we just held our own and we did as well as we did. Everyone's very pleased.
Ninth place in this national competition gets you $42,000, right, to restore a cabin on Rainier used by rescuers, which you called preservation with a purpose. What do you mean by that?
Thank you. I appreciate that. I love that phrase, preservation with a purpose, mainly because I love preservation of historic buildings. And this building was built back in the 1930s by people who came in and essentially built the park, the CCC. And so it's run down, dilapidated, falling apart, and it needs care. And the fact that we are able now to start investing in it and preserving it, preservation, that's great. But then taking it to the next level, and it's preservation with a purpose, and the fact that the building will now be used for the search and rescue volunteers who go up from all over the state and give of their precious time and volunteer and go up on search and rescue missions throughout the summer and the winter. When they're doing that, they have no place to stay right now. If they're up there for a couple days, they're either camping on the mountain in tents, cold, or they are sleeping in their vehicles, or if they're lucky enough to have a friend or even a home nearby. So preservation with a purpose. You know, it's preserving an historic building, and it's then going to be used for a wonderful purpose and a need that Mount Rainier National Park certainly has.
Why should Washingtonians feel proud and happy about ninth place for our big beloved Tahoma?
Because it's better than 20th. And we're getting $42,000 from Mount Rainier National Park. You know, that's fabulous. People were very committed to the voting process. People across country and around the world were contacting us. So folks were really into it. And they do it because it's one simple way for them to go in and say, I love that mountain. I want to be a part of, have an impact. And they all were. 61,000 plus votes from around the world. I think that's pretty cool.
What does 61,000 votes from people say to you about what Mount Rainier means to our region and maybe to America and the world?
I talked to a lot of those people. They emailed me, you know, so I got to hear firsthand what it means to them. And I'm fortunate. And then I get to experience that a lot. I hear from a lot of people from around the world, you know, and I get to be, I'm fortunate to be sitting right here today talking with you about a place that the three of us love, right?
You, and me, and the and our producer who brought,
yes,
you here today?
Yes, yes. The three of us love that mountain and love these national parks. I'm so fortunate that I get to hear all that passion and concern and care, and then I pass that on to the parks.
My brother's ashes are scattered on Mount Rainier.
Oh, see? See, I know, I know, I understand. And so thank you for sharing that. So it's a very special place to you.
What does Rainier mean to you?
It means the place that I can go to in this state, and I can, not on the weekends, but I can go up during the week, and I can get off the tar and get off the parking lot, and within 2 minutes, I can be off by myself and stand there and breathe deeply and do a spin and look around, and just my spirit, like so many people, it's like instantly, whew, it's restored. And we all need that.
You know, it's funny, when I look at Mount Rainier, I think of a cross. I'm not even religious. I think of a cross because it's like this thing that's always with us, sometimes visible, sometimes often not visible. But when you see it, you know, it reminds me of something. It reminds us of a dream. It reminds us of something literally bigger than us.
That is the part that I love most is, you know, it is incredibly spiritual. However we all define that, you know, when you look at that mountain, I mean, to me, it's also similar to grizzly bears. We don't control them. We can't control that mountain. We can't control the North Cascades. And I love that about it. And you look at it, you know, every day you drive over the bridge and I look over my shoulder, is it out? And then those times coming home, driving back over, there are those moments when those clouds are hanging over and the sun is pink on the mountain. I mean, whoa, you know, and all of us, every one of us in this region have that same experience. People do not look at that mountain and just go, oh, well, yeah. That's the life-changing thing for me, the restoring of my soul, just even seeing the mountains always does that to me.
Finally, Lori, you're obviously somebody who, with a great passion for our national parks. How are you feeling now that you've got this restoration grant?
I think it's great. I'm very excited about it. It's the start, and we have others who are starting to call in and say, what can we do? How can we help? Because we want to get it to the full funding for the project, and I'm confident in time that we will. I can't wait for the day when we're all up there and the first search and rescue teams spend the night there, and they have dry bunks and warmth, and they deserve that. They give so much.
Lori Ward is Executive Director of Washington's National Park Fund, a fundraising arm. And Mount Rainier National Park just won some of that money, $42,000, toward restoring this cabin for search and rescue volunteers. It is a fraction of what the project will cost. So Lori told me if you want to help, you can find out how to help with the project at WNPF.org. It's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're with us today. Microsoft says it is sorry for a party invite sent to San Francisco interns by a Microsoft recruiter. The invitation contained a lot of slang that is not directed at people my age. It was written for someone Bree Ripley's age. She's a radio producer. She was an intern and a work study student here at KUOW. I asked her to come in and translate for you this Microsoft email, which begins with the greeting, "Hey, Bay intern."
Bay is somebody that you know, that you're close with them.
I thought it was your boyfriend or girlfriend.
Your bae or your boo. I mean, those are kind of intertwined, synonymous. We got your work boo. We got your boo, who's like you sometimes maybe go home to. You text them. You hit them up. That's your bae, like your partner.
So why is an intern the bae of a Microsoft University recruiter?
Because it's also a term of endearment. Like I would text a friend like, "Sup, bae? Good morning. What's going on?"
Okay. Moving on, my crew is coming down from our HQ in Seattle to hang with you in the crowd. But more importantly, we're throwing an exclusive after party. There will be hella noms, lots of dranks, the best beats, and just like last year, we're breaking out the Yammer beer pong tables. Let's start with hella noms. Translation?
Hella noms. That means there's going to be so much delicious food there, Bill. I mean, we're talking all the favorite snacks. Tons of bevies, talking like Rainier for days.
And I always thought noms comes from num, 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 num. This is delicious.
Oh, yeah, that's because you can't stop eating because it's so good.
Did I just make that up or did I nail that?
No, you totally nailed it, okay. Bill. Like, I would highly recommend, you know, incorporating that if you want to encompass the whole slang of okay. This gen.
Okay. Finally, in bright orange all caps, it says, "Hell yes to getting lit on a Monday night." Do young people still say getting lit?
Just like that.
Do they? Because exactly. They said that when I was a kid.
But really? What did it mean?
Yeah, getting lit. You know, getting drunk. Is that how you would interpret it?
Totally. Okay. I mean, you're about to go out. You're about to roll with your crew.
Uh-huh.
You're gonna go see some pals. Maybe okay. You're on your way to a show.
But young people would say that. Hell yes to getting lit.
I don't.
Apparently, Microsoft would say that is all in favor of getting drunk.
Oh, well.
According to that email.
That doesn't surprise me. I mean, everybody's got to, you know, party it up. You got to go roll with your homies. Get out there with your work booze. You got to go have some fun with them.
Okay, so corporate responsibility aside, Bree, you are in the demographic. If you got this invite, do you want to go to that after party?
Probably not. That's kind of uncomfortable to me to read that in an email because, you know, a lot of the stuff that we do is like text speak. We're just kind of joking back and forth. And, you know, I never write these things in an email because, you know, as a young professional, you know, somebody who wants to be seen as a professional, I would never incorporate that. And I don't think that's best practice for teaching interns, you know, how they should communicate with their superiors.
So your advice to Microsoft is?
You got to set an example for how you want this generation to communicate with each other.
Bree Ripley, with a little advice for Microsoft there. Bree is serving as our millennial slang translator today, and when she's not explaining youth culture and slang to you, she's producing the radio documentary Tie My Tubes. Now, in fairness, it's a big company. There's a lot of people, and Microsoft has issued an apology saying the email was poorly worded and not in keeping with our values as a company. If you'd like to see the Microsoft invite that she translated, we'll tweet out a link to it right now at KUOW. I thought it was like Steve Ballmer's idea of how a youngster might talk. Who knows?